You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green, in for Steve Inskeep. In your health today, we'll hear about lung disease among people who've never smoked. But first, learning, well, relearning, how to breathe like a sleeping baby. Experts say good breathing technique can be a natural stress reliever. But as one student of music and breath has learned, old habits can die hard. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
If you've ever been in your car when suddenly the person in front of you slams on the brakes, the typical reaction is
this response. It's a natural response, and it's a good response. It helps us survive.
Ed Billinchone is a longtime instructor of breathing and movement. He teaches musicians using a method called the Alexander technique. He explains a quick gasp brings a rush of oxygen in, which helps to heighten our senses and respond quickly. But the trouble comes when chronic stress sets in. Then, Billinchone says, a lot of interactions start to feel like near collisions.
So that we're almost always doing this for no good reason. It becomes a part of us, and we never sort of release out of it completely because we've been doing it for so long and so many times.
Billinchone says the result for many of us is the bad habit of taking really shallow breaths or even holding the breath at moments. He says this interferes with the natural rhythm that you see when you watch a sleeping baby.
Babies breathe easily, softly, without awareness of their breath. And so that when the diaphragm moves, the backs move beautifully and their bellies move, and they're not thinking about it. It's just happening.
The diaphragm is the large dome-shaped muscle that separates the chest from the abdominal region. When we breathe in, the diaphragm contracts and flattens downward, sort of nudging the belly out of the way. So when you see a belly moving up and down gracefully during relaxed breathing, it's a sign that the diaphragm is fully contracting and expanding. Alexandra Phillips is keenly aware of all this anatomy. She's an opera singer, and breath is critical to her performance. But she says a few years ago, she was getting all tangled up, thinking about it too much.
If I'm telling myself, okay, be tall, you know, stand up straight, take a deep breath, what it translates to me is tension.
Phillips says with the anxiety of performing, she was almost trying too hard. She sensed a lot of constriction in her throat, which inhibited her breath.
So much of what my teachers were telling me was let go, let go, let go. And that's a very broad thing to say, and it was so frustrating. I'm like, well, what the heck does that mean? You know, let go. Great, thanks.
In trying to understand in a more technical way what it meant to let go, she connected with teacher Ed Billinchone for lessons.
I first came to Ed several years ago. I remember I was like, you know, way pulled up and
arched
and
in the back.
Arched in the back, like everything.
There was a lot of chest heaving, and her breath was far from natural.
It was very cut off from my my breath and core.
She winces and says the sound is sort of thin and reedy. But as she and Billinchone have worked on subtle posture changes to lengthen her spine and relax her breathing, there's been a gradual change. During a recent lesson, Billinchone directs her posture by placing his hand on her spine.
I like the space that you're creating in your torso, and I want you to think here, okay?
Okay?
Don't forget about that.
He's trying to heighten her awareness of this new posture.
Okay, yeah.
Billinchone says her sound is becoming much richer, and she's performing a lot of solos these days.
Brava! Brava! Very nice. Yeah, yeah.
What he's actually taught her here is how humans are supposed to breathe.
When your spine is lengthened, the muscles that act on the diaphragm are at their optimum resting length, and they have more potential for speed, strength, and power.
Alexandra Phillips says the bonus is that she feels more relaxed, too, something that deep breathing can do for all of us. Alice Domar teaches diaphragmatic breathing in Waltham, Massachusetts. She explains when we fill our lungs fully, it prompts a bunch of good changes in the body.
We get far more efficient oxygen exchange, which means that our heart doesn't have to work so hard and our blood pressure and heart rate come down.
At least temporarily. The struggle is to keep it down amidst our hectic lives. Alice Aubrey, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You may not have heard of Rhett and Link, but you might know their work. They're internet film producers. Millions of people have watched their videos online. And Rhett and Link have achieved something that many online filmmakers have not. They are profiting off the internet. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio brings us this profile.
Two guys pull up to a Taco Bell drive-thru. The tall one in the passenger seat has a guitar.
Pretty good. How
There's a video camera strapped to the outside of his door, and then...
I'll start with a taco, soft like a cloud. I want mine crunchy, I like to eat loud. I'll choose a chalupa, I'll grab a gordita. And two taco salads for our senoritas.
This is what Rhett MacLachlan and Link Neal do. They are comic filmmakers, or as they call themselves, internettainers. On YouTube and on their own website, they are known simply as Rhett and Link. They have produced more than 200 videos from their basement studio in a small town in rural North Carolina. Those videos have been watched more than 16 million times. And because it's what they do, they've even made the story of how they met into a song.
On the first day of first grade, we were both held in from recess, 'cause we were both writing profanity on our desk. We wrote beep and blank, our punishment was coloring unicorns. And that's when we became best friends. But equally,
we've been friends that long too. We were friends right from the start.
You know, looking back, you can see that you were wired to be an entertainer. Every opportunity there was to get in front of a group, Rhett and I would say, yeah, well, let's do a rap song.
At the Beta Club convention.
Yeah, it's like, who raps at the Beta Club convention? Rhett and Link.
But despite their early inclinations, neither thought of pursuing careers as entertainers. Instead, they went to North Carolina State University together, got married to separate women, and got jobs as engineers. But they still loved performing, and a friend's wedding gave them yet another chance. Link remembers part of a song they wrote for the rehearsal dinner.
We've seen Greg naked, soon you will too. Hope you enjoy it more than we do.
The song got a big laugh, and after the rehearsal dinner, their wives gave them the last push they needed to make a go at what they really wanted to do.
And at that point, you know, our wives say, you got a knack for that. You need to do more of that. That's what you need to be doing. It was like the green light to say, well, let's start setting our sights on something besides engineering.
But engineering was a paying gig. Making funny internet videos was not. Rhett's father-in-law gave them free studio space in the basement of his dentist's office, and they went about making this their career. They and their families lived month to month for a while, until they hit on a plan to make sponsored videos that don't look sponsored. Remember that Taco Bell drive-thru song? Taco Bell paid for it. And their latest viral sensation is sponsored by a company called MicroBuilt. Their clients are small businesses, and they wanted Rhett and Link to design a customer appreciation campaign. And for Red House Furniture in High Point, North Carolina, they use the touchy subject of race to comedic effect.
Look at the sofa. It's perfect for a black person or a white person.
This mattress is perfect for a white person or a black person.
At the Red House, where black people and white people buy furniture.
Someday soon, Rhett and Link may be more than just internet famous. Maybe an independent film project with an actual budget. But for now, they're back in the basement, where the motivation is just to try and be funny and pay the rent. If Rhett's father-in-law ever gets around to asking for it. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
We never deface public property again, so if you've got a kid who's writing obscene graffiti, give him a picture of a mythical beast and he will cease to write profanity. Don't write profanity, just color a mythical beast.
Finally, the shocking news about Michael Jackson's death last week had one unexpected consequence. It pushed South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's marital and political troubles from the very top of the news to somewhere in the middle of the page or broadcast. You will recall that Governor Sanford's unexplained absence over Father's Day weekend, sans security detail, caused heartburn throughout his state, even more so when it turns out that he was not, as he had led his staff to believe, hiking the Appalachian Trail, or, as he apparently led his wife to believe, having some quiet time to do some writing. Instead, he was visiting a woman in Argentina with whom he was having an extramarital affair, all of which he laid out in excruciating detail in a teary press conference last week. Can I just tell you, the political situation in South Carolina deserves our attention, but not necessarily because of the governor's awkward confessions. There's another scandal in the State House, and it's right there in the open for all to see, and it's this. South Carolina has the lowest percentage of women serving in state government than any state in the country, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Just 10% of the people serving in elected state office there are women. That's far less than the national average, which is just over 24%, and far less than next-door neighbors North Carolina at 25% and Georgia at 19%. South Carolina has the dubious distinction of being the only state in the country without any women currently serving in its state Senate. In the lower house, there are just 17 women serving in a body of 124. And perhaps it goes without saying that not one member of the state's congressional delegation is a woman. Why might this be, and why does it matter? The first question is especially hard to answer. It's hard to fathom that South Carolina's voters might be more resistant to female candidates than all of their neighbors in the Deep South. North Carolina has sent women of both political parties to its highest offices, governor and senator. So has Texas. Are women not running? They are. They're just not winning. It's not clear why. Why it matters is tricky, too, except that most people in most democratic countries have come to believe that it does. Now, some argue that women are inherently more honest than men and less self-aggrandizing, more likely to put the people's interests ahead of their own. Now, that's a tough argument to make when just a day after Governor Sanford was forced to come clean about his extracurricular exploits, Detroit City Councilwoman Monica Conyers was busy pleading guilty in federal court to accepting bribes. And Baltimore Mayor Sheila Dixon is currently under indictment for misappropriating funds meant to help out her constituents, just to name a few examples. But most reasonable people in most democratic countries have come to believe that a democracy is best served by having all stakeholders represented. And it's hard to see how that is the case when half the population is represented by only 10% of the people serving in key leadership roles. It also makes you wonder about the leadership culture. Is it possible that having so few women around in positions of authority leads to antiquated and adolescent attitudes about women? A boys will be boys and the boys will look the other way attitude about dishonesty in relationships? Who knows? I do know I can tell you the last time we had to sit and watch a woman office holder tearfully confess to adultery while her stony-faced male partner watched by her side. That would be never. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Wasn't exactly an exciting finish. It wasn't even a fast finish. But yesterday, Joey Logano became the youngest NASCAR driver ever to win a Sprint Cup race. Those are NASCAR's top races. He is 19 years old. Logano beat out NASCAR veteran Jeff Gordon to win the Lennox Industrial Tools 301 at the New Hampshire Motor Speedway. The race ended early due to rain, and Logano, who was running on an almost empty tank, was in the lead when the race was called. And Joey Logano joins us now. Congratulations on your win.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Must feel like a very big deal.
It's definitely a big deal. One of the biggest deals of my life, that's for sure. It was a dream come true to win your first cup race at kind of your hometown. You know, I was born in Connecticut, so to get your first win there with you know, your family and friends around is really neat.
Well, if I understand this right, you blew out a tire. You were able, as you were getting your tire fixed, to refuel. So you were in a strategically good spot because you had gas in the tank when other people did not. Is that right?
Exactly. We were able to refuel about, you know, 6 or 7 laps later than everybody else, which was the 6 or 7 laps that made a difference at the end of the race. So, you know, sometimes a little misfortune plays into your hands.
Now, all this time at the end of the race, you've got the NASCAR god, Jeff Gordon, hot on your tail. And describe what he was doing. I've seen it referred to as he was messing with your mind, trying to make you lose this race.
Yeah, well, what happened was that when it started raining, they threw the caution out. And
okay, now when the caution is raised, that's a yellow flag. That means you have to slow down because of the rain?
Right. And you know, we started making slow laps there for maybe about probably five or six, and I was just trying to save as much fuel as I can by cutting the motor off and coasting as long as I can. And he was just trying to get me to fire my motor back up to catch back up to the pace car. You know, it was cool, though, to get your first win, you know, with Jeff Gordon right behind you. You know, it's definitely a neat deal.
So if I understand this right, Jeff Gordon is trying to get you to turn your engine on so you'll burn up more fuel. You'll run out of gas.
Exactly, yeah.
And we have some tape of your crew chief, Greg Zipidelli, talking to you as you're racing, telling you to conserve fuel. Let's take a listen.
Save fuel for me. You got to save fuel. We're good for about 3 to 5 laps here under green, so we go quite a few, okay? Just save fuel. Roll out, shut it off, shut all your fans off.
Joey Logano, what were you thinking when you were hearing those messages?
I was pretty excited about it. I didn't even know I was in the lead because we were right in the middle of pit stops, and you kind of lose track of what place you're in during the race. So, you know, once the caution came out, they said, well, you're the leader. And I was like, man, keep on raining. And, you know, it worked out.
What does this feel like? You're 19, youngest winner in the history of the Sprint Cup races, 61 years. That's got to feel amazing.
It's awesome. It's one of my goals, you know, when I started this year. It's an awesome feeling. I would, you know, it's the one race that I probably wasn't expecting to win that we won. So it's cool. It's just a never-die attitude.
What did Jeff Gordon say to you after the race?
He came up to me, actually, before they actually called the race for rain. He came up to me in the car, and he's like, looks like you got it. Good job. And I was like, don't tell me that yet. Don't jinx this.
You didn't believe it.
Oh, yeah, I was sitting there waiting as long as I can. So I didn't want to leave the car or anything. I wanted to, you know, make sure it was official.
Well, Joey Logano, congratulations. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
That's 19-year-old Joey Logano. Yesterday, he became the youngest NASCAR driver ever to win a Sprint Cup Series race.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Joe Alonso thinks ahead. When he was a teenager, he laid out a 10-year plan.
I would go to college right around 18, graduate around 22, and probably wouldn't get married until I was 25 or 26.
Joe is now 24, and he's getting married this year without the college degree he'd planned on and, for the moment, without a job. As part of our series, Generation Next, we're hearing from people like Joe who've had to make hard choices and new plans in this economy. Guest correspondent Judy Woodruff has our final story.
There was a 40% chance of rain in New York City on the day I met Joe Alonso. Some people might hear a number like that and take a chance. But Joe is the kind of guy who checks the weather and packs an umbrella.
I'd be surprised if the Mets get a game in today with all this rain.
He's walking through the Corona section of Queens, where he grew up and still lives.
As you can see, it's a very Hispanic-oriented section of Queens. There's a big Italian community around here, too. Turn here.
Joe's family is from the Dominican Republic. His parents came here when he was a baby and raised Joe and 4 younger siblings in a small brick apartment house.
And this is where I used to live, that second floor right there. It's a lot smaller than I remember, but then again, I was tiny.
When he was a teenager, Joe liked taking things apart and putting them back together. He took computer classes at community college, expecting to transfer to a 4-year school. That was in 2006, before the economy went bad. But within his own family, money was already a problem.
My father at the time was self-employed, preparing income taxes, things like that. So his income was very variable. And my mother was and still is a travel agent. So, you know, there's a certain limit to what you can make. And it was tough with 5 children and rent and a lot of bills. And it was causing a rift in the family, you know. So it was something that was like, you know what, my mother and my father were the ones who raised me, and I got to help them somehow.
So the plan that Joe laid out at the beginning of this story, where he'd have a 4-year degree by age 22, he put that aside. He left community college to find a full-time job.
That was a tough decision because in the back of my mind, I just kept hearing my mother saying how she wanted me to finish college. But I just put my personal plans on the back burner in order to help them.
What did your mother say to you, though, when you made the decision to leave college?
She knew that I was mature enough to understand the risks. And she said, you know what, college isn't going anywhere. You know, there's always going to be a college that you could go to. But she completely appreciated it. You know, it did help her out.
Joe worked for a while, helped his family pay for groceries and other bills. Then he took a course to be a computer technician. Not exactly a 4-year degree, but it gave him the credentials to make better money. He eventually did get an IT job that paid about $50,000 a year. One problem, the year was 2008, and the economy was falling apart. Shortly after he was hired,
I was let go. It was pretty surprising, actually. But, you know, even if I had a 4-year degree, I could still be out of a job. In this economic situation that the whole nation is facing, you know, there's several people who have even their master's degrees and they're out looking for work.
And so is Joe. He's been looking for work for 5 months.
Hey, where are you? You want to meet us over there in Fridays?
His unemployment checks last through the end of the year, but he's imposed his own deadline. He wants a job by the end of next month.
All right, bye.
He's getting married in the fall.
How's the work?
Boring.
Slow?
It was really slow.
Joe's fiancée is Chriselle Perez. She's 23, works at a shoe store, and like Joe, still lives at home.
You hungry? Did you eat?
I had lunch.
What did you have?
They've known each other a long time and decided to get married 3 years ago. They settle into a booth at a restaurant, and Joe puts his BlackBerry on the table. On the screen is a picture that reminds him every day how much he needs a job. It's a tiny black-and-white smudge, a sonogram image. Chriselle is 2 months pregnant, another unexpected turn in Joe's 10-year plan.
It was something that we weren't expecting to do so soon. We were actually expecting it to do it next year. But again, it was when I got the news, it was like I was so happy. And our whole family is very happy.
I guess I'm wondering, do you wish you'd had more time to prepare for this moment in your life?
Yeah, everyone does. This, even if we're sitting there with a bachelor's degree, a good steady job, and a baby comes into the picture, I think everyone at some point or another says, I wish I had more time.
Back in the restaurant, Chriselle is telling Joe about her wedding dress.
I would have paid almost the same if I would have gotten it at David's Bridal or any of those stores. So since he's a friend of my grandmother, he's trying to give us the good price. So that helps us a lot.
They want to move into their own apartment soon. And to afford the rent, Joe is thinking of taking any job he can get. Maybe he'll drive a city van for a while, he says. That's what his father does now. I asked Joe about his dad leaving the Dominican Republic 25 years ago to start a new life in a place that held so much promise. My dad, he says, I think he's more surprised by this recession than I am.
He really had great expectations for this country when he came here, and he never expected for this to happen to such a great nation. But I guess for my friends and I, we see it as, I guess since we read the history books and say, you know, it's cyclical. It's happened before. There's going to be peaks and there's going to be downfalls.
But it is a tough time, nonetheless.
Really
How do
tough.
You think it's shaping you as a person? How is it affecting you as a person?
Since this is actually the first recession that I can remember, it's prepared me in a sense by telling me, you know what, if it does get better, I have to be prepared for when it could go bad again, because you're going to have a family and they're going to be dependent on you to make sure that things get done and get paid and that you provide for them. So I just have to be more prepared for it if it does happen again.
Joe Alonzo's plans now sound different from the ones he made at 17. In November, a simple church wedding with a potluck dinner afterwards. In January, the baby comes. As for college and his career in IT, that will happen too, he says. Just not exactly as he planned it. For NPR News, I'm Judy Woodruff.
Tune in tonight for Judy's final Generation Next story on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And you can find more from our Generation Next series at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
And here's something else to consider. Sometimes breathing problems signal some very serious and unexpected health problems. That's certainly the case with lung cancer in people who have never smoked. NPR's Richard Knox has this story.
Jill Costello is 21. She's a senior at UC Berkeley. She's a member of the crew team. She never touched a cigarette, but she just got diagnosed with lung cancer.
I got back from my national championships on June 1st and then went to the trainer later that week with some abdominal bloating and just discomfort.
At first, doctors thought she might have ovarian cysts. Then they did more tests.
They found some masses in my lung and liver and breast. So after some biopsies and tests, the next day they told me I had cancer. It's lung cancer that just metastasized to different areas of my body now, and bone, actually.
Metastatic lung cancer is scary, but she hopes the fact that she's in good shape will help. She says, I'm planning on knocking it out. Jill Costello is especially young, but it's not rare to find a diagnosis of lung cancer in people who've never smoked. Heather Wakely of Stanford University is Costello's doctor.
In fact, about 10% of men in this country who develop lung cancer have never smoked, and it's actually about 20% of women who develop lung cancer have never smoked.
That translates to about 10,000 men and 17,000 women who get lung cancer every year, even though they never smoked. Lung cancer in never smokers ranks with brain, liver, or ovarian cancer in the number of cases. More women get it than uterine cancer. But still, this diagnosis often comes as a total surprise.
It's complete shock. A lot of, why did this happen to me? And for some of them, it's there's anger about the fact that the finger is pointed at them for getting an illness that they had nothing to do with.
Kathy Reed knows that feeling. She was diagnosed 2 years ago.
I had had a cough for a whole year prior to that, and the doctors had just kept saying bronchitis.
Reed is a retired Marine gunnery sergeant and a marathon runner who lives in Virginia. She says people always assume that she must have smoked.
They look at you with that look. I say, I never smoked. I always feel like I have to defend myself. Not that it's right that anybody gets cancer, but it's like people are looking at me and thinking that I did it to myself.
With somebody who never smoked, the obvious question is whether secondhand smoke is the culprit. Dr. Jyoti Patel of Northwestern University says probably not.
Usually what we quote is that 15 to 20% of lung cancer in never smokers is due to environmental tobacco smoke.
The biology backs that up. Dr. Adi Gazdar studies lung cancer at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. He says the DNA of tumors from smokers shows telltale damage from chemicals in tobacco smoke.
Never smokers, lung cancers, lack this characteristic pattern that, to me, is powerful evidence that tobacco carcinogens are not the major driving force.
Also, most never smokers who get lung cancer get a different type than smokers do. Lucky for them, this type often responds to two new cancer drugs. They target and turn off a particular mutation found in patients who didn't smoke and in Asians, particularly Asian women. These drugs aren't cures, but they give researchers reason to think there will be other ways to defeat this unexpected kind of lung cancer. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Thank you.